I am Plunt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Judy Tayabji joins me again. The author and former politician has a new book out, Christy Clark Behind the Smile. It's a biography of the Premier of British Columbia. And a year before the next election, it's, as Vaughn Palmer said, a starting point in getting to understand the Premier and what makes her tick. The book's pretty good in giving the overview of Clark's life to recent times, especially how she was drawn into politics and how she won the 2013 election. That a lot of people expected her and the BC Liberal Party to lose. I'll ask Ms. Tayabji, who joins me now, to talk about the Christy Clark she's known for over two decades, and the record of her government, as Vaughn Palmer suggests in his column, what it takes to beat her, which possibly is found in this book. I'll also get Judy to address the controversy surrounding the book, whether the relationships, political or otherwise, might have had a part in how this book came about, or at the very least its portrayal of Premier Clark. Judy Tayabji was the MLA for Okanagan East from 1991 to 1996, was a member of Powell River City Council, as well as a television and radio personality hosting programs. She also wrote two previous bestsellers, Political Affairs and Daggers Unsheathed, The Political Assassination of Glenn Clark, which, like this book, are welcome additions to the all-too-few books on British Columbia politics. The book is published by Heritage House. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Judy Tayabji. Ms. Tayabji, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
I'm fine, thanks.
So let's start with the controversy surrounding the book, because I think that's what a lot of people are talking about rather than, say, what's in the book.
Right.
It has attracted a lot of controversy, as you might have expected, as to how people dismiss it as nothing more than a hagiography or even payback because of your husband's job or other alleged inducements. So I guess you must have expected this, and having expected this, why did you pursue writing a book like this?
Well, actually, I did expect that I would make myself into a political target. I did not expect the mischaracterization of my private business from 2012 and 2013 as if I was somehow being paid to write a book. And that's what I'm referring to when I say these alleged grants that actually were never received, monies that were never paid to me, as if they were connected to the book. And to give you some insight, I am actually suing Maclean's magazine for the way they have characterized things, and part of the conversation has been them saying, but this appears in the Tyee and the Georgia Strait, and the NDP have been talking about it. It's like, yes, it's all wrong. The difference is that I have higher expectations of the national news magazine than I do of social media or online blogs. So all I will say is the only thing that is true is my husband is a senior civil servant for the government. He works for Minister Shirley Bond. The Premier did create the position in 2013 after the election, but he has not met with her or seen her since. And just like any other senior civil servants, he works very hard for the people of BC. His job is to create jobs for British Columbians as an advocate, specifically in the LNG industry, although he has also assisted with BC procurement in things as diverse as the Nanaimo Harbor and some mining operations, etc. So he's just one of an army of people who work for the government. It's not a patronage appointment. He's paid market rate. In fact, he's paid the lower level of market rate, and I have yet to receive a penny for the book from any source, including Heritage House.
If the Georgia Strait and the Tyee had it wrong, why aren't you suing them?
Honestly, and I don't want to be mean, but I don't consider them to be credible as an independent source of information. They are outlets for people who already have a partisan persuasion that's NDP, and all of the social media stuff has been spread by NDP people, and 30 years ago I learned that people will believe what they want to believe. So, you know, where Maclean's is different is they put the article in a national news magazine with Sophie Gregoire Trudeau on the cover. I'm a liberal, and I have an expectation that when I pick up Maclean's, I have a fair and objective treatment of a book review, and that's not what happened. I don't have that expectation of the Tyee and the Georgia Strait. Maybe I should, I don't know. And yeah. Maybe we'll enjoin them, I don't know.
Yeah. So what interested me in reading your book, other than, say, that it records a lot of history politically, which is, I've told you in the past, you know, there are too few books on British Columbia politics, was this idea of getting to know what Christy Clark is like. I mean, she's been in the public eye for a little over 20 years now. She was first elected in 1996. But yet, what fascinates me is that we don't know as much as we perhaps ought to. And I guess that was the impetus to writing the book. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. What I was seeing was this huge disconnect in the public conversation about the premier in terms of her value system and who she is and what people were hearing every day. And it really came to a head, as I'm sure you've read the book by now, Joseph, because I know you.
Yeah.
I know you're very good at doing your research. The book happened because of the yoga on the Burrard Street Bridge controversy, which I saw escalate through social media. It was being mischaracterized, and the premier was being... Really, that was the first time that we saw this narrative that she's some sort of corporate sellout, and in this case, she was alleged to have sold out to Lululemon, who were sponsors of this free family yoga event on the morning of Father's Day. And as I saw that play out, I thought, you know, I'm really disturbed at a fundamental level at the hatred that was being so freely expressed, which ended up manifesting itself in an event that people could attend to effectively murder the premier in a public venue and also murder Chip Wilson. And I thought, you know, I don't agree to be part of a civil society where that's part of the conversation. This premier, whatever you think of her, you don't have to vote for her and you don't have to support her politically, but you do have to respect that she's our premier and you're not allowed to actually engage in conversations like that. So I took some action myself to shut down that page and to make sure there was a police follow-up, which happened. And then I also thought, you know, I need to look into the idea of writing a book. It was just an idea that landed me a contract so fast that obviously the publishers thought that there was merit in it. I want people to have access to information if they want to find out about it, about a little bit more about who Christy Clark is and what her journey has been to become Premier BC.
So Mosa Hoda says in the book that one of the I guess weak spots of Premier Clark is that she's seen as superficial, and I guess in reading the book and wanting to get to know her, that comes up a lot throughout her career, and so she's also underestimated a lot. Having known her for as long as you have, and having seen her behind the scenes, if you will. Is she the same person that we see on television every night? I mean, or is that a put on? Is she some sort of phony like every other politician say?
Well, I would say that you see the same person, but when you see someone on TV, you're only seeing them for 10 seconds, 15 seconds. So you're not getting any depth or context, and that is what the book is for. And I think Mosa Hoda is one of the most talented politicians BC's ever had, and that means he's really good at spin. And ironically, people used to say about Mosa Hoda that he was all sizzle and no meat, and that's what he's saying about Christy Clark. That's his job as somebody who wants the NDP to be in government, and I included it there because that is commentary that we hear all the time. Do I believe that? Based on my research, I don't think it stands the test of any kind of scrutiny. Christy Clark is able to walk into a room and charm everyone and put on that smile and make everybody feel like they're part of her inner circle. She does that very, very effectively. But she can also sit down in a working session, hammer out excruciating detail on international trade agreements, on climate policy, on job creation, and she can follow through with implementation in the face of unbelievable obstacles. So, like her brother has said that I quoted there, you know, she's tough. She's very tough. And you don't see that in a 10-second clip.
And is the substance there? Like, does she read a lot? And not just read a lot, but, I mean, does she read widely?
Yeah, she actually does. She's a real geek. And I was actually surprised, because even though I've known Christy Clark for over 30 years, I knew her only within the political arena. So I'd see her at a public get-together. I remember during the constitutional debates in the late 80s, when it was Meech Lake and then later Charlottetown, I know she was intellectually engaged in the constitutional debates. Now, you can't be intellectually engaged in a constitutional debate without being a policy nerd. So I knew she already had that passion, but she also has a perspective that's really hardwired into the provincial interest. And what I mean by that is when British Columbia was feeling excluded from Confederation, she was quite comfortable standing up as a federal liberal, a staunch federal liberal, multi-generational liberal from Canada and say British Columbia wants to be relevant in Confederation, and therefore these are the grounds for not supporting this deal. And she didn't feel that that threatened her position politically. So that takes a certain perspective. There are a lot of people who wouldn't stand up in BC and take on the Federal Liberal Party because they were worried that, you know, maybe that means we won't be relevant to the table. And for her, the issue was more important than it being a popularity contest. And I think we see that over and over in her choices as leader. And in writing the book, I was blown away by the reality of how difficult the work was for her between 2011 and 2013, because I, like most so many other people, encountered her in the news, and she was always smiling.
Yeah, and she you talk in the book about how because she was at NW hosting a show and making the transition back into politics, how difficult that was for her.
Yeah,
and just she had no one around her, really.
She had no one, and I know that. I think it's not a secret. I've walked my own difficult path in politics, but I had Gordon Wilson as my partner from the time those difficulties began, and I don't know how I would have put one foot in front of the other sometimes. And she was particularly isolated. When they say it's lonely at the top, that's not a figurative thing. It really is, because you don't know who you can trust. And I can't imagine sitting down, looking around the caucus table, and just not knowing who was going to brown envelope the notes from the meeting so that you could read a headline the next day that was going to make you look like a bimbo, you know, for example. And that's what she was dealing with, and she navigated that. And she did it without cracking under the pressure. So I don't know how she did it, but she did. We all saw the effects. And we've seen an increasing focus in the last 6 months of this conversation that she's heartless and really tied to the corporations. And I think what's interesting about that is how different that is from who she actually is. And I'm hoping that some people will get to encounter who she is. I mean, this sort of tomboy who grew up barefoot in the Gulf Islands in the summers, you know, a product of a middle-class urban family. That's who she is. Yes, she can rub shoulders with royalty and carry it off, but she'll also hold the hand of a senior in a senior center and make him feel really important when no one else is visiting him.
Someone who doesn't come off well in the book is Gordon Campbell, and I was interested in the book about the relationship that they had because, as I mentioned a moment ago, she was first elected to the House 20 years ago and so was part of the BC Liberal caucus that Gordon Campbell led from that time to, I guess, up to 2005, 2006, when after their first term, I guess, after
right.
They were elected in 2001. What was the nature of their working relationship? Because we used to see, you know, the two of them on the news a lot. She was number two, supposedly, in that caucus, in that government. You quote people in the book who say that they didn't really have a working relationship. They didn't have a relationship other than, say, working together. It was never personal, and as I said a moment ago, he doesn't come off too well. Was he jealous of her, do you think?
I think that I would use the word threatened by the power couple of Christy Clark and Mark Morrison. And, I mean, previously we talked about how she was alone during 2011 to 2013. That's because at that point she was legally separated and on her way to a divorce from her husband, who Mark Morrison was consistently her biggest protector and, you know, organizer, supporter, and to this day is still very supportive. But at that time, when she was with Gordon Campbell, she was in that power couple, and it would be hard to imagine a more powerful couple in Canada at that time. And you see that in the BC Rail chapter, where Mark Morrison is working for the Prime Minister's office after having helped, you know, get Paul Martin the leadership. He's now working for the Prime Minister's office, and she's the Deputy Premier of British Columbia. So that's amazing to have that. That's a dynamic that influenced a lot of the conversation. And Gordon Campbell, to my knowledge, had no real interest in the Federal Liberal Party at any time. His affiliation, and I have not interviewed Gordon Campbell, so I have to be very careful here. I only have this from other people, that when he spent time in the United States, he was more affiliated with the Republicans. I don't know that directly. certainly that matches what I observed. And I'm not the best person to write about Gordon Campbell because I was never in a party where he was leader.
Right.
So I have to put all of those cautions out there. I deliberately did not interview the premier about her relationship with Gordon Campbell because she's the premier of a coalition where many of the people in that coalition were and are supporters of Gordon Campbell, and I tried not to compromise her ability to continue to do her job because she's heading into an election, and she was very good about answering any question I put in front of her, and I asked the questions of other people like Von Palmer and Keith Baldry and people who were around who observed them, and that's why you'll see so many of them making very frank assessments that she had no real power. I, after the book was finished, had some information about decisions that were made behind her back that I have yet to ask her about and at some point might do a bit of a follow-up story on, but they were consistent with what I heard, which was effectively Gordon Campbell, for all of his ministers, was more or less letting them know what they were going to do for the government. He was very much in control of the agenda. I think Christy Clark, as we've seen, is a leader in her own right. And so I think that would be very hard for somebody who has those leadership abilities to be in a position of authority in terms of title, but not have any real decision-making power. So probably she did the very best thing she could do for everyone and pursued something else. And that's what you should do. If you don't support a leader and you're a person of integrity, you leave the party and let them get on with the job they're elected to do. So
that's why she left in whenever that was, and I guess after the first term, right?
Yeah, and you can see from her speech that I quoted quite a bit of it at the end of the chapter where she's announcing her decision to return to private life. She is also a new mom at that point, but the dynamic at home wasn't going to be helped along by the fact that Campbell was setting policy that was very different from the policy of the Federal Liberal Party. And we were heading into the Stephen Harper era, so probably in BC's best interest that there be a premier that was more in line with Harper's agenda anyway. So I don't want to put words in her mouth, but certainly you can see from what she did say that she felt her time was better spent somewhere else.
So we're heading into an election next year, and this case that between the government and the teachers' union is on its way to the Supreme Court, and I'm sure opponents of the premier will appoint to that and say, well, she had, you know, that whole thing about class size and composition. I mean, she was Minister of Education at the time, that it was her doing. So are you saying that as Minister of Education, she didn't have the free hand, that it was being run out of the Premier's office?
Well, that's pretty much across the board been the consensus. And that's why a lot of ministers, I mean, you look at Carol Taylor, they didn't last very long. There's quite a few examples of people who lasted, you know, one term and then left. And I would say that there's more than, I mean, I'm not going to say that the premier told me this because I didn't ask the question, so I didn't get the answer, but it's very easy to conclude that the decisions were being made out of the premier's office for things like funding, class size, contract negotiations. Having said that, what you can hold this premier to account for is the first negotiated province-wide collective agreement between the teachers and the school districts. And she didn't blink. So the minute that she became the premier, she said, we have province-wide bargaining, and you will bargain. And unlike the previous governments, whether it was Campbell's Liberals or the NDP, who all ended up legislating the teachers back to work, she insisted on a negotiated collective agreement. And I don't know that people understand how important that was. Her father was a teacher, and she understands the entire dynamic of teachers and the teachers' union at a visceral level. So I actually am one of those people, I don't think she's going to be that vulnerable on the teachers' issue because it is seen as a partisan issue. So even if she gave them everything she wanted, they're going to be campaigning against her because that's where their affiliation lies. She's not going to give them what they want. She's going to give them what's fair. And that's what's in the best interest of British Columbians. And I'm not saying that as a partisan. I'm saying that as somebody who's observed the education system now for over 30 years, and I'm glad that we're taking the politics out of it.
She was also Minister of Children and Families, and I'm sure you know, Judy, from the news. I mean, that's been in the news a lot in the last little while and will continue to be, because it just seems to be a problem for her as Premier and the previous Premier and for governments, you know, going back to you know, years ago. I'm sure you're well aware. Do you think the opposition will try to paint her as not having done anything in that file?
Yes, I think so. Minister of Children and Families is a no-win ministry, and it's no win for a government that is already being characterized as heartless and selling out to corporations. That's the narrative. And in politics, you can win by having a narrative stick, but it has to be true. So let's dissect that. When we come to the campaign, I think it's objectively proven that this premier is an effective communicator and is very good at campaigning. So John Horgan is going to have to be saying that she's sold out to the corporations and she doesn't care about children. But he's going to have to be saying that to a premier whose government has had the highest level of construction of affordable housing in British Columbia history and has started the single-parent employment initiative to take parents and give them an opportunity for free training and education to go straight into the job market with all the daycare for their kids paid for. So she's got a lot of initiatives, and that's just a few. There's also the farmers market vouchers for seniors and families who are on lower income, where they could actually have access to local food, which is more nutritious and usually more expensive, and that program has been expanding every year. There's many, many examples of policies that this premier has overseen, and she knows them way better than I do. I only know the few that I researched. So I'm sure that just knowing her personality, she'd say, bring it on. You know, I mean, you can't stick with that narrative when she's unedited in front of a microphone.
So you devote a chapter in the book to the BC Rail saga, and you know, there are a lot of people who think that the whole story isn't there, and I guess they had hoped that the NDP would have won that election in 2013, because as the NDP claimed, there would have been as they promised, there would have been a public inquiry. In terms of the story and what we know and what possibly happened there, why are the names of Christy Clark, her ex-husband Mark Maris, and her brother Bruce Clark, why are they attached to this story, and what have you found in your research in the course of writing this book as to what their role was in all of this?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. I have to tell you that when I first thought about writing the book, I thought, okay, well, one of the first things I'm going to have to really focus on is BC Rail, because I've been hearing about it for years, and like pretty much everyone else I've talked to, I automatically associate with Christy Clark. So there were two things I knew. I knew Christy Clark's character, and I knew that she was associated with this BC Rail controversy. I said, okay, I need to satisfy myself with my research. What did she do? So I start doing the research on BC Rail with the presumption that I'm going to find out exactly what did Christy Clark do in context with the sale of BC Rail that led to her and her husband and her brother being implicated in a criminal investigation. That was my thought process. And I start to do the research, and I can't find anything. I can't find anything. So I interview Marison, and I say, well, I want to talk to you about the BC Rail thing. Could you please tell me, you know, what happened? So he tells me the story that you'll find in the BC Rail chapter, mm-hmm. and he gives me the specifics of his interaction on that file, and it was only his, which is all connected to the Federal Liberal Party and his role with the Prime Minister's office. None of it with criminal implications at all. Then I call Bruce Clark, and I say, Bruce, I would like to interview you about BC Rail. And I mean, I'd known Bruce Clark a little bit when I was a teenager, and he was a bit older, and but I didn't know him very well, so I think he was very nervous about, why am I talking to this woman, and is he going to hurt my sister or whatever? And he said, I've never given an interview on BC Rail. I said, well, I really only have one question. And he said, but I'm not going to give you an interview on BC Rail. I said, okay, that's fine. You don't have to. But my question was, why is your name associated with it? I can't find anything that connects you. And he just burst out laughing.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, you're the first person who tried to ask me that question. I can't answer it for you. I don't know. So that was all I got out of Bruce, and I only put a snippet from that in the book. Then I thought, I'm not going to ask the premier. I'm going to go to Vaughn Palmer and Keith Baldry and say, where do I look? So they gave me some information, and I looked, and the truth is, they're not connected with it at all. Mark Marison is the only point of contact, and everything else is political spin. And You'll have to read the book to find out what that political spin is. But clearly, the people who wanted to attach it to them, they won the spin on that. And that's what politics is. The book is not going to probably undo all of that, but it will give people who were prepared to give them the benefit of the doubt why their names are attached. And I have to admit, I wasn't giving them the benefit of the doubt. I was convinced they were involved. They weren't involved at all. So when I finished that chapter, I actually thought to myself, you know, one day I'd actually like to write a book just about BC Rail and do the research that goes into the Bassey-Virk stuff, see how much there is there. But I think most of it has never reached the light of day because they settled out of court, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I'm sure they're tied by accepting these settlements as to what they can say or
yeah, that's right.
The figures and such.
But they wouldn't give me interviews. I did try through their lawyers.
But. Yeah. So, because she's been such a target, not only for her colleagues or opponents and the media, and will continue to be so in the campaign forthcoming, mm-hmm. Do you think it's easy to target her because she's a woman?
I think it's easy to target her because not only is she a woman, but, and pardon me for being so honest, she's very beautiful, she's very sexy, she's very charismatic, and she's interesting. So the one thing that you know, and I'm sure if I were in the media, I'd be trying to put her in my newspaper, on my TV show, on my radio show as often as I could, because there are some people who have the X factor, and that means if they're on the cover of a magazine, you're going to buy it. And she's one of those people. She also happens to be unbelievably smart and working really hard for the province and running for office. So it means it's open season on her when we get into an election campaign. What I was hoping to do with the book is try to change the rules of engagement a little bit and say, these are the things she's had to endure, and I think that they're not acceptable. Or it wasn't really about what I think. I've been putting it out there, and other people have been saying, wow, that doesn't seem fair. Great. I'm glad we're having that conversation, because that was what I thought personally, but I just wanted to give people more information so that going into the next campaign or the next 5 years or whatever, we just have a bit more civil conversation, because having been a woman in politics, and I've got daughters, I now have granddaughters, I don't want the bar to be so low that women say, I would never want to endure that, because why should I have to put up with those kinds of comments? And I feel like there is more permission, even since the book came out, for women to say, you know, I've experienced something like that too. So there's at least some common ground of saying, because I've experienced that, I don't support her politically, but I also don't support her having to deal with that kind of stuff. And I've been hearing from John Horgan over and over that this election for the NDP, the gloves are off, and it's going to be, you know, down and dirty. And that's not the rules of engagement that I think are in the best interest of the British Columbians, because a lot of people tune out negativity. So I'm trying to build a different conversation.
Yeah, and you have a chapter in the book. What's the name of the person who presents the report in your book about just how she's viewed and
Right. Yeah, it's Dr. Kremeld Malkin. And I just need to say this, because the reason that Dr. Kremeld Malkin is the person who writes that is because I could not find an academic woman or person in British Columbia who would be prepared to talk about the premier. And there's this contempt among the academics in British Columbia that, to me, is it partisan, or is it because the premier didn't finish her degree? I don't know, but Dr. Kremeld Malkin lives in the Eastern Maritimes, and she had no preconceived ideas about Christy Clark, and I kept coming across this theme in the interviews that I was doing. I interviewed about 40 people for the book, and so I identified this X factor, and I went to her and I said, listen, I've read a lot of your stuff online, because Kremeld Malkin does a lot of online blogging about current events of all kinds, international affairs, domestic affairs. And I knew that she was a psychologist, and I said, a PhD. Would you please consider providing me with a couple of pages for my book about Premier Christy Clark? And I happened to observe in her previous post, I didn't think she was a particular fan of Premier Christy Clark. You know, I think she was persuaded that she was a bit heartless and, you know, bad with for the environment or whatever. And I knew that Kremeld Malkin was fairly left-wing, but it didn't matter. I also knew she was fair. And I didn't care about her politics. I just wanted an academic consideration of the media treatment of Premier Christy Clark. And not just media, because the media are only reporting what's there.
Mm-hmm.
So she gave me what's there, and partway through, she sent me a note and she said, oh my gosh, how has this woman endured what she's been through? And I said, well, it's British Columbia. So you see a very edited version of what she did. I think in her research, it quite changed her perspective of Christy Clark. I find it interesting that in Alberta, an academic came out to defend Rachel Notley from one incident. Where are the academics in British Columbia? Because there's a deafening silence. And let me tell you something, Joseph, that nobody else knows. So this is exclusive for you. There was a time when BC hosted the first ministers in British Columbia, and I believe it was last fall. And it was a time when Canada had the most female first ministers at any time in its history. Half, I believe.
Yeah.
There were five or six.
Yeah.
Pardon me, I don't pay that much attention.
Yeah, it was about half. Yeah, five, I think. Yeah.
About half. And at UBC, they were offered an opportunity to host a summit of the female first ministers, and every female first minister said yes. And there was an academic professor, a woman, who vetoed it at the last minute and said, I can't stand the thought of Christy Clark setting foot on campus.
Hmm.
And so she vetoed a summit, a public summit, of Canada's female first ministers because she had a problem with Premier Christy Clark. And I'm fed up. Come on, women. The average woman is looking up to Christy Clark and saying, wow, she's pioneering. But a lot of women in influence, whether it's jealousy or partisanship or whatever it is, I don't know what it is, they're deafeningly silent. Not all of them, but enough. And I think we need to change the conversation.
So not just the sexist criticism that this premier gets, but the other criticism on policy, on messaging and the sort. Seeing her behind the scenes, does that wear on her at all? I mean, how does that affect her? Because, I mean, you and I read the stuff online about her. I mean, I'm sure she does, too.
She does not read anything online. And when she's, if anyone tries to tell her about it, she says, I can't listen to you. When I was interviewing her for the chapter on the Water Act, which toward the end of the book, and she started answering the question, I burst out laughing, and she just looked at me. I said, I'm sorry. I got to take a break to say, what just came out of your mouth is the opposite of what I'm reading every day. And she said, I can't do anything about that, but I can amend the Water Act. So let me tell you about protecting groundwater. So I know that what came out of her mouth was the truth because I could objectively prove it later, but it was the opposite of what's online. And she puts up shields about it. She won't be able to have those up during the campaign. I don't know that it wears on her because she does have support from a few people who are close to her. But I think that it disappoints her. She doesn't know who she can trust. She's a very, very trusting person. And that has allowed some people to get close to her who from the beginning were planning to set her up. And I saw that in one instance with my own eyes. When I saw how much trust she was putting in someone, and it's none of my business. I'm not politically active, but I was waiting to meet with her, and this person walked out of her office, and my jaw dropped, and I said to her, I don't think you should trust that person. Quietly, I said, I know it's none of my business, but I think you're going to get set up, and 4 months later, front page, complete setup. So that's what I'm saying, is she wants to believe the best in other people. And so she just has to be careful who she trusts, I guess.
So the 2013 campaign, I mean, a lot of people, up to election night, were thinking that this was hers to lose, or she was going to lose it, the party was going to lose it, the NDP were going to come in. At what point did she know, did they know in the campaign that they were going to win it?
Well, you see, the funny thing is, when I interviewed people, and you can read the book, how many people I knew all along. No,
yeah.
They didn't. But I quote them, yeah, we knew all along. The truth is, they knew on election night, when the returns came in, and they were irrefutable. That's when they knew. She had an optimistic feeling, but she is an optimist. And you couldn't survive what she went through without being an optimist. Sharon White, I think, was one of the best. She just said, we knew something was happening. We knew something was changing. We could feel it shift, but it shifted really late. And I think it shifted because a lot of people came home, a lot of people were prepared to give her put some trust in her because her personality started to come through unedited. Now they haven't really seen directly from her. She's been busy running the province. And yet every day they've been reading and hearing things that are very, very negative. So I think in the campaign this time, she's going in a bit disadvantaged. She's a known commodity now, and I think some of the branding that's not accurate has stuck enough that she's got to peel some of that off before people can see who she is. But I think ultimately voters are going to give her a fair chance to have her say, and I think she's going to be very articulate.
So, I live in Vancouver, and the issue of affordability, I mean, it's in the news every day.
Yeah.
David Eby with the NDP is trying to hammer that home, and I'm assuming that the NDP will in the campaign to come. But you write something interesting in the book, and I think it was Bruce Clark who said this, that you saw in 2013 the Liberal Party and this Premier especially not focus on the urban centres, and that's why she lost in Point Grey to Eby.
Right.
You know, which is a traditional, say, Soak Red, BC Liberal seat. But by focusing on rural parts of the province, the heart of British Columbia, if you will.
Yeah, the wealth generation.
So do you think that that's where she'll focus, and will the NDP get traction with this pitch to affordability in urban centres, say?
Well, you see, the thing is, the affordability complaint is a two-edged sword for the NDP. Why are we having issues with 0% vacancy in places from Powell River to Kelowna? And the reason is because BC's economy is booming and the rest of the world, I mean, look at the Brexit vote. Canada is a beacon of hope to the world. British Columbia is the best part of Canada, and the urban centers are the first place people come. So our success has the challenge of affordability, but the challenge can be met with proper planning, and we have a good economy. And as I said before, highest number of affordable housing units ever created in the history of BC. So that'll be part of the campaign dynamic. But every great city, whether it's London or New York or, you know, you name it, Hong Kong, reaches where Vancouver's at. Vancouver has become a global city, and that means that it can't be the way it was in the 50s and the 60s for people. And what that means for places where I live in Powell River, people are moving in because they want to recreate what they had 20, 30 years ago. That's actually the urban demographic and human history. That's what happens. So you can try to blame Christy Clark, but that's like blaming Gregor Robertson for homelessness. These are issues that come as one of the byproducts of a very successful economy. The good news is it's in some ways a good problem to have because some people are benefiting from no capital gains taxes as they sell their grandparents' house and get to buy a piece of paradise in part of Vancouver Island or the interior. Is the NDP going to make it an issue? They are. Will it be one that sticks? Maybe. That's not my battle. That's going to be the battle that all of us will tune in for during the election. And really, that's part of the democratic process. I hope that the election is fought on the issues and not on side issues or allegations or distortions. Because if it's fought on issues, then I think we'll get a good government outcome, whatever it is.
And if the NDP decides to go nasty or will go nasty, do you think she can herself?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
If, as you said, and as the NDP has said, I should say, they will go nasty in this upcoming election, can she fight them the same way?
No, I don't think so. I can't see Christy Clark going into the gutter on that. It doesn't mean the party won't. I think that party operatives tend to make those decisions in the heat of a campaign. And ultimately, as voters, we will have to decide. You just have to look to the south of us to say, you know, what kind of outcome do we want for our democracy? We're the ones who reward or punish people based on what they present to us. I really hope in the next election people tune in to the messages and they actually show up. I hope the negativity doesn't leave people at home. And I think it will be a nasty election, and that's unfortunate. But I think that's also a side effect of social media.
No, the positivity message worked for Justin Trudeau, though, right?
It really did. And I think, every time I start to feel a bit overwhelmed by the Trump thing, I think about the Trudeau campaign. I just am so proud of Canadians because not only did they show up for the positive message, it was a resounding, definitive, we are prepared for hope and hard work. Hope and hard work works for us up here. We're voting yes for that. And I don't know what they're going to do to the South. I actually had a conversation with our sons the other day, and I said, you know, if John F. Kennedy Jr. hadn't died in that plane crash, would we have John F. Kennedy Jr. to the South now and Justin Trudeau here? Would they recreate Camelot in the White House? Like, and what a different world that would be, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know that they have that opportunity, and I'm glad that we took ours when we had it, and I hope there's a positive message in the next BC election campaign.
So, Judy, you've written about two premiers named Clark now. it seems like a good place to compare the two.
Yes.
Because you've known them. Well, you knew Glenn Clark, having, you know, sat in the House with him for a number of years, and you wrote that book on him, and you've known the premier for at least two decades. It's more apt to compare those two than, say, each of them with, say, Gordon Campbell or Mike Harcourt, right?
I definitely agree with that. I'll tell you what, and the funny thing is, I don't think Glenn Clark or Christy Clark will like what I'm about to say. But let me tell you that if you subscribe to the idea that clans produce similar traits, what you have in both Clarks are populist leaders. They're both very scrappy, very articulate. They think on their feet. They fight for what they believe is right. They're tough, 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 and they both have earned every single thing that they've gained. And Glenn Clark and Christy Clark enjoyed debating each other in the House on opposite ends. They, in my observation, both subscribed to rules of engagement in politics that meant we will argue this out until we're out of breath for our different positions, but they wouldn't have called each other names. They wouldn't have questioned each other's, you know, past choices or family history or, you know, there were still rules at that time, which is ironic because both of them are characterized as street fighters.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they're characterized that way because they're scrappy and they're feisty. And a lot of people dislike both of them for being so quick on their feet. So.
Yeah, and as premiers, I mean, if let's say she loses the next election, both of them, I think, will be regarded in history a little bit better than they are currently. Is that your view?
Oh, I think that both of them, in 50 to 100 years, people will focus on the good things that both of them have done. And I believe very firmly that if Ujjal Dosanjh hadn't launched a criminal investigation against Glenn Clark would have stayed leader. And it would have been very difficult to have him lose the next election for the NDP. But without Glenn Clark being taken out by that criminal charge, Gordon Campbell would have had a very tough fight in the following election.
What's your next book? Are you working on something else now?
Well, I was going to joke and say, well, I don't know. If Christie's son Hamish Marison Clark runs, I guess I'll write a book about him. But actually, Heritage House have asked me to put together a small book of the things that we couldn't include in this book to come out in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
So that may happen. I'm not 100% sure about that. If there's time, then I might do that. And otherwise, I'd just like to go back to my sheep farm. Every now and then, it's like this invisible hand pushes me forward, and that's what happened with this book. This book was a compulsion. I felt like I needed to write it, and I don't have an off button when that hits. But, you know, the last time it hit was 2001. So, you know, there could be a huge gap between this and the next book.
Will you have a part in the next campaign?
I don't anticipate that I will. Contrary to what you've read on social media, I'm not active in the Liberal Party, and there would be many people in the Liberal Party who I think would specifically not want me to be active, and that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. If I do play any role at all in the campaign, I would be getting involved in my riding of Powell River Sunshine Coast, which is where my husband was elected. We have had an NDP MLA for the last 10 years. He was one of the people who very incorrectly and irresponsibly shouted conflict of interest at me in February when they were trying to smear me before the book came out. And that fundamentally changed my perspective of him. I haven't found him particularly effective for the past 10 years, so I've been neutral. But now I really am unhappy at a personal level. So I might get involved in the local campaign in my riding to help elect a Liberal.
But throughout a couple moments in the book, you give the Premier advice. or through Bruce Clark, and it turns out to be good advice. And
did I really? Where was that? Remind
well,
me.
your wedding anniversary with Gordon. You're having lunch with the premier, and you suggest that she should run in Kelowna.
Right. Right.
And she said at the lunch she didn't think of it, and well, she did.
Yeah.
So I mean, in that sense, I mean, you still have sort of, you know, you're politically savvy, you know, not to patronize you or anything like that.
Well, I mean, thank you very much. I feel like my best role is as a communicator. And you know, the funny thing is, well, you've read the book, but for your listeners, it was my dad saying to me, you know, there's a very credible rumor that the premier is going to run in the Okanagan.
Yeah.
Now, we had a role to play in the last election, which again was that invisible hand pushing me to nag my husband.
The video, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so she wanted to take us out for lunch, which was on our wedding anniversary, as you said, and that's where I mentioned it to her, and I thought I was acknowledging something that she'd already discussed, and she looked at me like, I'd never thought of it. And then I tried to underplay it, because the truth is, Joseph, I don't feel like I'm qualified to give the premier any advice. I haven't been paying attention. I could give her advice on sheep farming, for example. I would give her passionate advice on food security, water protection, protection of urban forests, because that's where I live right now. But I would never presume to give her political advice, because it would be terrible advice, because I just don't know. So I kind of held back a little bit when, I said, well, it would be, you know, be kind of nice to have a, you know, premier from the interior again. And of course, having grown up in the interior, I'm actually very passionate about it. So if I had been non-restrained, I would have said, you have to do this. But I thought, no, I can't do that, because who knows? What if it's a terrible idea?
Yeah.
You know, so obviously it just went into the hopper, and somebody thought it was a good idea. It just was serendipity that it was a rumor my dad mentioned to me that I mentioned to her that became considered and turned into being a good idea. So
she's not like Van der Zandt, where Van der Zandt would take ideas from people, you know, that he'd run into on the street, right?
No, I'll tell you one thing about Chrissy Clark. She does her homework. She reads everything. She's voracious. And I actually, we had a standing joke, because I actually was very fortunate that after I'd gotten the first 15 chapters, I ended up in Vancouver quite a bit for this court case. Mm-hmm. I won't put any adjectives in front of right now because it's still ongoing, but when it's over, I can't wait to talk about it. But anyway, so I was actually within walking distance of her house, and I would walk over a couple of times and do the interviews. And the first time I came in, she said, oh, did you read this book? And she had all these geek books, right? And she said, I've never heard of these books. I said to her, no, I only read romance novels. And she laughed because she thought I was joking. And then, you know, the next time, oh, have you read this? I said, no, I only read romance novels. So the third or fourth time, she said, what about this book? I said, okay, you really need to understand, I'm not kidding. I have to read so much serious stuff as a matter of my management consulting and the things that I do, that if I pick up a book to read for pleasure, it's a romance novel.
So
stop putting these geek books in front of me. I'm not going to read them. But she reads everything.
Has she read this book?
Okay, so if you'd asked me before it was launched, I'd say no, because I gave her a chance to read an advanced copy.
Yeah.
And then when it was ready and when the press gallery had it, I sent a message through, you know, like, where do you want it delivered? And it was like, well, send it to the office. And I thought, well, no, I can't have a galley's version floating around the premier's office. So I sent a message back saying, it needs to get into your hands. And there was this funny, she's usually very, very direct, but I was getting these squishy things. So finally, I got a direct message to her. I said, could you please just, when you have a minute, at any time,
yeah,
in 5 minutes, give me a call. So she phones, I guess, but she's on her way to pick up Hamish. And I said, I just need to ask you, do you want an advanced copy? And she said, no, I don't think I want a copy. I can't change anything. I just can't. If you've made me look like an idiot, then I know you've been fair, and I just have to live with it. And I said, okay. That's fine. After the book came out, I know that someone bought a gift copy for her in Vancouver about a week after it came out. So I know that she started reading it about 10 days ago. I know she's pretty busy, and it's 400 pages. So I know she hasn't read it. But I have received a couple of private messages from former Liberal MLAs, and they have, to my intense delight, they've said that they're surprised at how accurate my description was of the 2001 to 2013 period, because I wasn't involved at all. And that's great, and that's a credit to the people who gave me interviews. So I don't think she's finished it. And I'm a little nervous because, you know, it's, contrary to what's been said, there's a lot of stuff in there that's not that flattering.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's fair, and I think, personally, having done all the research and in a fair assessment, she's an excellent premier, and I stand by that.
It's been a pleasure talking again, and my understanding is the book is on the bestseller list. Is that right?
I'm so happy. It's 3 weeks now on the bestseller list. I thought it would have take a few weeks to get there, but I guess there were some advanced copies, and it's all organic. Like, it's not like there's a political party or, like, there's the Vancouver Tree book is being supported by the City of Vancouver, and there's a couple other books on there that are being supported by school districts, but this is just out there. Heritage House, you know, I've got Leslie Kenny from Heritage House doing publicity, and she's been great, but there it is. It's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, it's nice talking again, and the next time you're in Vancouver, drop by, and I'll get you to sign my copy.
I will definitely do that, Joseph, and you'll have a library with three Tayabji books all signed.
That's right, yeah. The book is called Christy Clark, Behind the Smile. It's published by Heritage House. Its author, Judy Tayabji, joined me on the line from Oliver in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.